Yo, what's good, folks? This is Jesse out in Oakland, California.
Josh in the land of Christmas items.
What's up? It's Marvin here in West Philadelphia.
What's up, everybody? This is Michael in Williamstown, Massachusetts.
We just had a few announcements. Just want to remind y'all, continue to tune in to our Melanated Mindfulness Mondays. That's every Monday on IG Live, happening at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And if you haven't checked them out before, make sure to tap into the IG videos and check out some of the previous Melanated Mindfulness Mondays. In addition to that, please make sure that you hit the link in our bio, hit the link tree, and make sure that you donate to the Venmo or the Cash App to help support us continue doing this work, y'all.
For sure.
We appreciate everybody listening, doing what they do. And today we have another special guest. We're trying to get more special guests in the building to hear from different perspectives. And we have a special guest, Tigis Khabib, reporting live from Melbourne, Australia. She is a therapist and she's doing some dope work. Can you tell us a little bit about, yourself, where you're from and all those good things?
Hi, everyone. So I'm Tigis Khabib, Melbourne, Australia. It's Melbourne's gang. So I'm a counsellor. I have a huge Instagram presence and, not to be too cocky, but I try to do a lot in terms of activism around mental health in the black and brown communities in Melbourne. So I'm at the Coloured Therapist. I work as a sexual assault counsellor. So I do a lot with trauma and family violence. And in the private sector, I also provide counselling through Polar Psychology. But you can find all that on my page. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm so excited. I feel like we're repping so many different time zones.
Definitely. Thanks for being on our show.
So just for context, for people who are not from Australia, we had a pretty decent response to COVID, I believe, compared to like places like America, compared to Europe, because we're seeing what was happening overseas. And you have to contextualize that Australia is an island, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a lot more control around who's entering and who's exiting. And we're traditionally very conservative as a country. So there was a lot done, but now, with the new waves and the spikes that are occurring in, especially in Victoria, which is my state, and Melbourne, which is my city, which is the capital, the capital of Victoria. The huge response around it has been very ethnic and very culturally specific and really focusing and targeted towards cultural groups and certain people of specific class and ensuring that the wider public think that it's because of these classes that this is happening. When in reality, COVID first came in and was quite rampant in Melbourne in these white, rich suburbs. And we just kind of had to deal with it, right? But the minute it kind of was transferred towards black and brown suburbs or suburbs with low diversity, it's like, lock them away, shut it down, let no one exit in. They don't understand. They don't get it. They're so vulnerable because it's like, no, we get it. You guys gave it to us. So, okay. Which is exactly what happens in the States as well.
Yeah.
And the people who suffer are the minorities.
I was reading today that, well, just in general, for one thing, people really don't know that there's black people everywhere, but, there's black people from Zimbabwe, there's black people from South Africa, black people from Ethiopia, black people from Somalia. And I was also reading today, it was actually, I think, a Muslim family that they had a premature baby in a hospital. And then when the shutdown happened, they couldn't go see their child. And they had to be away from their child for 5 days. And the Department of Health and Health Services, they had to call to get the baby milk. The baby couldn't get the milk in the allotted time. The parents had to get COVID tests. They had to get all this gear. And then the father was like, I was away from my child for 5 days. It felt like 5 years. And then the mom was like, I still can't touch my child. And as clinicians, we think of the lack that a child can get from their parent. That affects their attachment and that affects the nurturing relationship that a parent and more specifically a mom can have with their child,
Yeah, just to give you some context about that case. So, like, I'm going to get emotional about this. I'm just going to give context because I know we've spoken, but for listeners that don't really know what's been happening in Melbourne. So last week on Saturday, I don't have the date off the top of my head, our government decided that due to the amount of COVID cases, and I think that number, it was at 24 cases in 12 families or 13 families mm-hmm. in a specific area, that they deemed it was appropriate to shut down 9 public housing estates. So they all go up to like 20 levels, mm-hmm. with nine apartments in each of those levels, which is approximately 3,000 people. So our government decided that because of 24 cases in these 9 estates, positive cases, that it was a public health issue, and that these housing estates were almost like cruise ships, and that's how likely they were to spread the virus. And as a result, that their rights and liberties should be taken away from them and it should be shut down. And as soon as our premier, which is the equivalent of a governor, stated this at 4 p.m., by 4:30, 500 police officers were sent to 2 areas, which are 5 minutes walk from each other, which house 4 flats on one side and 5 flats on another side, to shut everyone in and not being able to leave. And they were told for 5 days and it was extended to 14. Mm. So as a result, 3,000 people weren't allowed to leave their homes. 3,000 people weren't allowed to engage in outside. So these are tiny apartments, often 2 or 3 bedrooms. They weren't allowed to receive any light, food, medical resources. Till now, and we're, I think, day 7. And so by day 5, they had found enough evidence to show that there was actually no reason to shut down all these towers. This is actually a departmental issue with public housing, not supplying enough PPE, not supplying enough resources. Some of these towers, one of the elevators have been shut down for months, and now it's only one tower who can continue because they had 50 cases in there of around 200 residents. So that's the fight that we're having. And the mum that you just brought up, just to connect it back together, community has done everything. They've provided food, they've provided medicine that the Department of Health and Housing has not. And even in this case, it was community members who advocated hard for her. So we're down at the local mosque and just working out of there, all these volunteers, I took time off, everyone took time off from their work to just volunteer their time. And one of the girls who's a child, you know, counsellor, was so distraught that she was getting all her connections together, advocating for this woman who spoke Arabic only, and she spoke Arabic as well, was getting everything together because she wasn't able to see her child even after testing negative of COVID. She wasn't allowed to leave her building because her building was technically a prison and she was in detainment. And her child, who was a preemie that needed milk, she couldn't access it. So this young advocate did all the best to care and had to do the smart thing and get a politician involved. Right. And that politician was like, this looks great for me. If I get a child out to see a mother out to see her child. So he got involved, and then he then spoke to the hospital board and got ambulance to take her from her building to the hospital, which is 5-minute drive every day. But what happens is every day a DHS worker, a Department of Health and Human Service worker, would be like, why are you going downstairs? And restart the whole process and re-traumatize this mum every time she wants to leave her house, even though it's been approved by the head honchos. So even a small case like that had required the mum to be traumatized, the dad, the child, and the mum to be traumatized every day in order just to do something as basic as getting milk to her child who's a preemie. So I'm not sure if I can swear on this podcast.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah.
The whole situation is so fucked. It's you know.
And I know before you asked about how we are basically with social justice as therapists, yes. And that was kind of what you said is kind of a segue in regards to, you know, you say that from your Instagram, you're not a normal therapist, but an intersectional therapist. advocating for the strength, trauma, and healing of Black folks. Can you, I know you kind of said all that before, but can you give us a little bit more of what that means and what you're saying about yourself?
I think from my experience, and I'm sure this is the experience of so many others, is that due to racism, due to sexism, patriarchy, white supremacy, all the words, right? Often a lot of parts of me aren't invited into the room. So if it's at work, I can't invite my Blackness. Or if it's in, you know, certain conversations in my culture, because I'm Ethiopian background and I speak Amharic, and I'm also Christian as well, Orthodox, I can't invite certain feminist views into that. So the reason I wanted to really focus on intersectionality is that people are intersectional. There's different parts of us, and society views these parts and attributes power to each part of us. So if it's our gender, if it's our sex, if it's our race, our class, all that, it's not just something that we're feeling. It's the way society is interacting with us and attributes. So in this situation that's happening with the flats, it's blatant classism and racism that's happening, right? And because of that, the government has deemed them vulnerable, which means there's inherently something wrong with you that we need to protect for our own white safety. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean when I'm trying to say intersectionals. I wish to invite all of that person right. into conversations with me. Right. And I want to focus on Blackness. And the politics is a little bit different in Australia, as those people from First Nation backgrounds identify as Black as well. I know they spell it differently. So sometimes you'll see the C dropped off. So I'm inviting that Blackness as well, because there's a different history in terms of Blackness here. And for me, I'm like, anyone who identifies as Black is Black, and I invite you here. And mm-hmm. our struggle is a lot different to mm-hmm. to other folk. And being in a white Australia, that struggle is really different. And coming from an African perspective, that struggle is really different as well. And we don't mm-hmm. talk about mental health. We don't have these experiences where there's freedom to speak. And even in the flats examples, a lot of the work that I'm doing is I'm doing a quick order for Panadol, which ends up being a crisis call because it's like, I haven't gotten Panadol. And as a result, I'm feeling suicidal, la, 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 or this kind of stuff. Okay. It's like paracetamol, sorry. And I think that's kind of what I want to do. And I'm using my page just to normalize it, just to say, hey, guys, here's a voice from Australia. Here's a voice that that is local to you, that normalizes these things and is including activism in her work. Because if it wasn't for the oppression that exists in these groups, there wouldn't really need to be a reason for a therapist, really. Like, I don't feel like there's reason for us to... Oh, there is, but like not as much. And and our self-care wouldn't be as radical as we wouldn't fight for it as hard if it's not the same when Black and brown folk are saying we need self-care compared to a white person saying we need self-care. It doesn't mean the same thing.
Right. What's your kind of self-care being a Black therapist in a pandemic? And then there is not a lockdown, but a lock up. Like, what's that been like personally for you?
Wow. Not a lockdown, a lock up. That is exactly what is happening. Right now, there isn't. So just to give context, I had the majority of my family in those towers. Mm-hmm. I couldn't separate myself. The overlap was too much. And that often happens in our movements, whether it's here or overseas. Like the Black Lives Matter movement, for me, it's like, I can't separate. I'm Black today, I'm Black tomorrow, I'm Black when I sleep, I'm Black when I wake up, I'm Black when I'm marching, I'm Black when I'm not marching. I couldn't separate myself. So right now, a lot of the work I was just thinking about writing some stuff up about like activist burnout and going back into Black burnout, because in a crisis mode, which is what we're in right now, there is no self-care. Self-care is me spending some time with talking to you guys instead of being on the front line. Self-care is sleeping, eating, and showering for me right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's just, and that goes to show with Black women as well. Y'all always on the front line. There's a WNBA player by the name of Natasha Cloud, who she actually sat out for the year for the WNBA season to be in the bubble. And Converse is actually going to pay her salary. And she said, because, you know, in America, we're doing all these statues of the statues getting took down. She's like, taking down statues of racist slave owners, that should have never been put up. That's crumbs. We need real change. And the Reverend Michael Rinder, a.k.a. Killer Mike, says, now is the time to plot, plan, strategize, organize, and mobilize, but also self-care. So it's a struggle that we all as therapists and providers, you know, kind of deal with.
What are you guys doing? So I know that, for example, the Black Lives Matter movement, just because it's the most recent one, it's been going on for years. How are you all taking care of yourselves so that you can still be part of the movement, but also not die trying to, you know, because that's what it is. It's death, which is on the other side. Yeah.
I mean, so I think generally I'm trying to find a balance in my life that I don't know if I've ever been able to find. I'm realizing more and more that, like, I only know how to operate at two speeds, where I'm either going like 100% or zero, and trying to find something in between that allows me to just continue to be like plugged in and allow for enough space for like my own care is something that like I've never really learned, and it's like a relearning. And I'm like actively in that process right now, and it's like messy and confusing and is filled with like guilt and shame at times. But trying to like navigate all those pieces. But like I've been telling these folks, like the parts that have been like the most rewarding is like getting back to reading. And like reading the work of like Adrienne Marie Brown, and just like other like pieces of fiction and like dope Afrofuturism, and just looking at like how other people like envision a future, is like getting me out of this space of like being so connected to the here and now, but allowing like, okay, we are like moving in a direction and these are models for like thinking about what does that look like, you know?
For me, I've been writing more than I have in the past, like non-academic related, more personal. And I found a lot of value in like penning my thoughts, particularly during these past few months. I'm not at a place where I'll share it widely, but it's just nice to have put something down on paper, and just have another place to hold everything. I've also been in community with people who are committed to Black liberation. And that is like, when I'm in that community, when I'm with people I trust, like that's a chance for me to just breathe. So I found a lot of value in just being with trusted folks, writing my thoughts, trying to move my body every once in a while as I restore. So, but it really depends on the day for me. You know, some days are better than others, but thinking about sustainability here, like those are some things I'm trying to do for the long run.
Mike, when you say you write, man, you working on a mixtape? Like, what's good, Brett?
Oh man, my days of writing raps are long gone, man.
I'm still trying to get this Melanated Freestyle Friday popping, Brett.
I just wanted the two things that you guys had pulled up. And I'm just going to bring this up because you guys all kind of work in mental health. I think it ties back to the body, and having our nervous systems so activated and in such like survival mode and being fight and flight all the time, being able to get to a place when we are able to stop and read and to stop and write, I think that's amazing. And because for what the experience I'm having is, because we're currently going through it, is that I'm so jittery and I'm so shaken. And even when I'm at home, like I'm so overwhelmed that being able to find a certain level of calmness to be able to focus your mind, I think has been the hardest things for a lot of the community volunteers because we're so antsy.
Yeah. I know, as far as, like, to answer your question about the self-care, it's kind of similar to what Jesse was saying. It is a balance because social worker Dr. Joy DeGruy says white supremacy is produced out of a fear of annihilation. So, you know, and also James Baldwin, basically paraphrasing, said to be a relatively conscious Negro in this country means that you're always enraged. So to balance that, I've been talking about for many episodes now my yoga journey. I actually did some yoga before we got on, and I felt very present. I felt very grateful. I felt that I should just pace myself, and I'm always trying to get more. But just to, I know we talked about it, or at least I've learned from my melanated social work brothers, just to have compassion with myself. I actually recently, my partner's dad got me a bike. So I've been biking. I started hiking, changing up my calisthenic circuit, being off social media, and advocating for myself because I know my worth. So that's what I've been doing to answer your question in this state that we're in.
Yeah.
I think for me, the three biggest things are making sure that I eat and drink, just very simply. Mm-hmm. I typically don't have breakfast, and so I have to keep reminding myself to like make sure I eat something. And that really does make a difference, you know, every day. The second thing is just is working out. Like I started working out, which is I'm using my body now, and also I'm working out outside, so I get the sunlight and everything too, which is nice. And it's just a nice start to the morning. And the third is my therapist. Just saw him today, unloaded everything on him. So, but it's been really helpful just to get through this time right now.
Yeah, but I really appreciate like what you bring up, Tigas, and just like thinking about like pieces around stillness or the self-work and how in a lot of ways folks of color have lost that because of the product of like white supremacy or colonialism or internalized capitalism. Like I think about like myself being a non-black person of color, being the product of immigrants, like my previous generations never had the luxury of self-care. It's always been like your existence, your identity is tied to work in such a way of survival because you need to provide. And then even thinking about like the context of like the black experience within America and like the racial trauma of slavery and like thinking about how the idea of like your labor is tied to your survival, because if you are not working, you are expendable. Mm-hmm. And then like, how is that passed down intergenerationally? And then how does that allow or just inhibit our ability to just like stop and focus on self? Like that shit is really hard to just like reprogram.
And I also think like in terms of history, that history that you mentioned, I think is now kind of the impacts of that globally. Like I'm Ethiopian. I'm an Ethiopian migrant to Australia. No connection to the Atlantic slave trade at all, no connection to America, but experience the impacts and the legacy of the belief of black and brown bodies here. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's how global it is. It's that white supremacy has, and as a result of colonization, has created these beliefs about what it means to be of color, what it means to be black, and what it means for our worth to be so tied into our productivity and how much we're doing. And the idea of, because essentially what a lot of you all are saying are creating space and boundaries and kind of creating space for yourself when historically that never happened. I was always, or black bodies have always been the property of someone else and have always been tied to some type of whiteness. And I think doing that, I think is so important, and it can get lost. And I think just to tie into what I mentioned earlier about the role of mental health care workers and how if we're not bringing in the history, if we're not bringing in the intersectionalness of it, how this can get lost and how further trauma can occur.
I mean, absolutely. I was listening to, he had a controversial song called Nature of the Threat by Razzcass. And he basically said black people were called Negro because it was a way to have a demarcation
of profit off of them. And kind of bringing it back to, you know, your work and the ancestors. I was looking that you work at, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, Pola Psychology. And Pola is a Zambian word meaning to heal or to recover. It is the action of healing, an action motive towards restoring, recovering, and sometimes reconstructing. How has your work been there at Pola Psychology?
So just to give some context, the person who created Pola Psychology, who made this space possible, is Nasa Lithia. And she is a clinical psychologist who's Zambian. And from what she's explained to me is that she wanted to create a space that it was culturally responsive. And she couldn't find anywhere. Like, she's like, I want to apply for a private practice space that has this, and couldn't find it anywhere. So she made it. She made it herself, which is also a testament of the legacy of people of color who have to just make space for themselves. Mm-hmm. And our story is a bit cute. I said, it's almost kind of like an awkward romance story where I slid into her DMs going, hey, I just saw that you've got some jobs available. Hi, my name is. And then, you know, we had this kind of long, kind of awkward getting to know each other through Instagram and started working together. And we both kind of had the same values and belief systems around well, first of all, our own experiences of racism, but on top of that, in the mental health space, it just being like this black void that just no one talks about or introduces, or when it does. So my experience has always been like, oh, we've got a person of color, they're African. Tigis, do you want to work with them? And it's like, okay, they're from Nigeria, I'm from Ethiopia. We have like no language. I still have to use an interpreter. And even for the people who I speak the same language on, the burden has always been upon me to provide those services. The burden has always been upon the people of color and the organizations that I've been on to do cultural competency and not get paid for it, and to do all that kind of stuff. So we're just like, look, we don't want people to not have opportunities. So we started working together, and a lot of the people who are coming to us are minorities. So just all type of minorities. It can be people from gender and sex diverse backgrounds. It can be racial and diverse backgrounds. And that's the reason why they're coming. They're specifically coming for this reason, to have themselves included, because certain parts of them are not included. And given that we're this huge minority in Australia, I have people calling me from other states to do Zoom sessions because they couldn't find anything in their state.
That sounds like, I know before we actually started recording, there's so many similarities from you were saying about, I guess, for one, if you're that one black person in an agency, they're going to come to you. I've definitely, and I know my brothers can attest to, if you are a black man or a brown man in this space, it's like, I'm going to use some like some fake names, but, oh, Josh, can you go help Dante? Can you go help Jaquan? You know, it's all those things. And I was just telling my partner, who's also a woman of color, just to, you know, you don't always have to give people, when they ask you something, that's more labor for you, because they're going to come to you about, you know, certain things. And that kind of leads me to my next question in regards to, well, how did you get into mental health? And tell us a little bit about some of the populations. You kind of talked about it before, but in general, you have a lot of a rich work experience. So how did you get into the work in serving all the populations that you have and that you do?
Okay, so I got into mental health two kind of ways. So the first way is I've always been that person, whether it's my friendship groups, whether it is in the circles that I'm in, who people are sharing things with me and will disclose things, and I've been able to hold and provide perspective for people. I didn't think that could be a job. I just thought that was the burden of friendship. Like, I just thought that's what you do as a friend, right? And you know, you kind of do that work. I thought that I had a background in like legal studies and law. Like, that's what I was like trying to go towards. Quickly, I found out that was not for me, and I hated that environment. And the other side of it is, I think, you know, my identity, and I think that the constant experience of things such as like racial trauma, family violence, sexual assault, and all that kind of stuff that's happening in and around me and the way that's been responded to by my communities. So again, I come from an African background. I come from a religious background, and the way we talk about my racial trauma, so all the kind of stuff that had happened for our families to get to here, and then the interracial relations that happened with other minorities, and the audacity of a lot of things just going under the carpet. Like, there would be someone in our community who has been sexually assaulting children, and we just kind of like, oh no, and no one has said that. Oh, you know, you just can't have your children around this guy. No, that's illegal, right? Like, this, why are we protecting someone that goes to our church, that goes to our community events, that we just protect our children? You know, this is actually like, we should protect all children. This should be a thing that, and the level of betrayal that is felt for, like, what about his family and his kids, and or whether it's family violence? It's like, oh, let's just conceptualize and understand that, you know, he just thinks he's a man and he's trying to provide, and that's why he hit her. And it's like the gaslighting that occurred. And I was just kind of like, no, this is actually not okay. And it's actually having a huge ripple effect onto the community. So I just really wanted to get into that and kind of dug my feet into it, and I said, I don't want to actually leave this space. And I started off with young people and doing, you know, kind of community work with young people, moved into drugs and alcohol, which was kind of like a whole new sector for me. And then kind of fell into the trauma kind of side of things, into sexual assault. And I was like, this is where I want to be. Not because I love sexual assault, but the trauma aspect and focusing trauma in all the work that you do revolutionized me. It was like, yes, I need to focus with trauma. That should be my basis in doing my work, because I can understand everything else. I can understand drug and alcohol. I can understand politics. I can understand everything if I'm focusing it from this perspective. And I've just been working in sexual assault, I think, for like the last 3 years now.
Mm, that's like a very intersectional lived experience. I think that a lot of us clinicians have from, you know, first day of social work school, they'll, you know, your first class, they'll be like, oh yeah, you're in social work school because you're always that person and you're saying similar things. And in marginalized communities, you know, that happens. Like, I know a lot of things that happened in my family, from the anti-blackness that they had to deal with in the South to the misogyny and the sexism that happens. And then for my family, you said migration, African-Americans were part of the Great Migration in like the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and stuff. It left the South to the North and the West. And it's always that those experiences that kind of bind us. Or for those that come from an immigrant population, those are those stories that they kind of bring. And also, speaking of the states, I see that I think you mentioned before that you studied at Eastern Carolina. How was your time in the States, and how did you get to the States?
So I've always wanted to kind of go out and do something. And I had, like, in my mind, America to me was like Christmas. It was like, I want to go there. 'Cause like a lot of wider black culture is influenced by America. Like, white culture is influenced by black culture, you know? So I was like, I want to go there. And, you know, I had an opportunity to be an exchange student. And just to kind of go back on, you guys in America, especially in the South, there are some fucked up insects that exist.
Yo. Yeah, scorpions down South.
You guys have, like, you can't see me, but they had, like, mosquitoes that were, like, this big. What's going on?
Those are facts. Those are the facts of life right there. My next question is, if you were in the Carolinas, what restaurants did you frequent? Like, what chains or what was catching your attention there?
Oh, this is, like, you guys are checking my card. I'm so stressed. This was 10 years ago. So, okay, what did I go to? I went to Cookout.
Yeah.
Cookout. Hell yeah. Yep.
And then I also went to somewhere, which after I went there, I side-eyed for a very long time because it was my white friends that took me there. I went to, like, Cracker Barrel. And I was like,
hell yeah!
He said, hell yeah!
Bruh. Like, this place looks like the set of a slave film. Like,
bruh, it
had the rocking chairs in front.
Oh, yeah. Yes! It's like rocking chairs. And they were serving, I'm going to say something really political in a second. They were serving me food, but it was coming from white people, but it was black food. So I was so confused. So the political thing I'm going to say, I'm sorry in advance. I'm so sorry. Just please, I come from a different country. Like, please, I couldn't get on board with grits. I'm sorry. Whoa. I'm sorry.
Okay. Not everybody likes grits.
Disgusting. It looks bad. It tastes bad. It doesn't have any good, like.
All right, folks, that's all from our guests.
She said, did you get yellow grits or did you get white grits? That's a difference.
Yellow.
She like, I ain't fucking with any of it. Salt, sugar, fuck all that shit.
And you only put salt in your grits. Only put salt in your grits. Never put sugar in your grits. It's cultural.
The only thing I do with my grits is throw them away, all right? Like,
Party foul.
Melanated social work listeners, our guests' views are not representative. Just want to let everybody know that. Okay? I know we got many listeners in this. I love shrimp and grits. Okay.
Hell yeah.
Look, in my country, they eat like intestines, and I can't get on board on that. You know, the same part. Of certain cultures that you just like, look, I accept every part of you. I just don't like that. And that's fine if you like it. But it just has bad PR as well. Like, it doesn't look great. Like, like it's called grits. Like, I was like, oh, am I gritting my teeth? Why am I eating this? Like, so
I would not allow you all to bad mouth grits.
I feel you, Marv. I love them.
But in terms of, like, I think the biggest, I'm just going to chuck in a mental health aspect for that, because there's all this kind of, like, different culture shock of going into another country and understanding. I understood my own blackness when I went to States. I my anti-black views that I had about myself, my colorist views I had about myself, and being raised in, even though I was from, like, an African background, all the spaces I occupied, whether it's work or at school, and everyone was white, right? I realized it was a big journey for me afterwards and changing my mentality around a lot of things. But in terms of, like, the mental health side of things, I think, like, I was doing some criminal justice subjects while I was there, because, again, that's what I thought I was going to get into, and some political subjects. Just, like the idea of rehabilitation and healing, it's just out the door. Like, we were doing case studies of, like, this, you know, like, I might get this wrong, and I'll just give you an example. We're doing this one, and it was like, you know, what do you think is the appropriate response for this family where I think a 9-year-old child, it was a African-American family, 9-year-old child went upstairs or maybe he was nine, I remember, because there was a comment made about by a white person that pissed me off. There was a 9-year-old child, and this was 10 years ago, and I still remember this. There's a 9-year-old child who went upstairs to the crib of his younger brother and poured gasoline and lit the baby on fire, right? Now, that baby would have been, I think, a toddler or something like that. That baby died, right? And then we're watching this interview about this mom who's saying, like, I've lost both kids. So, like, that baby died and my other child is now juvie and, you know, the case is taking so long, he might be tried as an adult and all that kind of stuff. What do you think should happen? I'm thinking, this is the easiest case. I already know what should happen, right? He should get tried as an adult. What? Yeah. He should serve life. What? He knew what he was doing. He was 9. Sorry? How is that? Make that sentence make sense. Like, how does he knew what he was doing? He was 9. make sense. And I think that was the, like, even now I'm getting super angry about it, because that was the biggest thing. Like, the idea of guns being just like, yo, I have like 5 guns in my house. And this, I had to go to Thailand to touch a gun. You know what I mean? Like, that's how different it was. And I think that's the biggest experience that came out of North Carolina, is that the ingrained criminalization and justice response from everyone, just even from students.
Yeah, it's pretty reflective of our culture. I mean, someone does something and it's like, lock them up.
Right. It's like
as a black man, we have a 1 in 3 chance of going to jail.
Yeah.
1 in 3. Mm-hmm. There's 4 of you here. There's 1 of you guys. Mm-hmm.
It's literally, like, it's so sad because America ranks so low in everything, like education, healthcare. The one thing that we are the best at is putting people in prison. Mm-hmm. We have more people in prison than any other country, like,
quote unquote, land of the free.
Yeah.
And we're also good at increasing COVID cases, because you look at Germany, you look at all these other, you look at the UK, it's going around, but, you know, America, there's no money in the cure or the stoppage thing. It's money in the mistreatment, you know? And that brings me to my next question about, we've kind of talked about it, just like in this moment in time, you know, us as, you know, black clinicians and clinicians of color in a very tumultuous and for some polarizing time. It's not polarizing for me because this is all about Black Lives Matter. All Black Lives Matter. There's no balancing it. You're either this or you're that. But in this space with, you know, Breonna Taylor's killers are still, you know, they haven't been convicted or anything like that, right? And I know there was, I think, weren't you, before I kind of close out and I didn't go on my Instagram, weren't you part of protests for Black Lives Matter in Australia as well?
Yeah. So the protest, pardon me, the protest here, I think, came a week after the protests in the States and all that kind of stuff. So it took a little bit longer just to organize and whatnot. But it ended up being like Australia-wide, and nearly every major city had a form of protest that was happening. Our Black Lives Matter case protests were around all the statistics that you guys say about African Americans is the statistics here for First Nations, right? Mm-hmm. So right now the biggest movement in that is around Aboriginal deaths in custody. Mm-hmm. And since the last, gosh, I'm horrible. I should have checked this up on this, but there was a huge Commonwealth Inquisition around deaths in custody. And, you know, they basically proved to say that, you know, institutions and all that kind of stuff were really negligent in the way they treated Aboriginal lives. And as a result, would be dying in custody. And since that was like 20 years ago. And since then, we're in like 340 something Aboriginal deaths in custody that we've got right now that no one has been convicted for, no one's been charged for, no investigations have been done for. And that's kind of what the protests were around here. But the amazing thing, so that's what, when we're saying Black Lives Matter here, we're speaking about it globally, but we're speaking about the Black First Nation lives though, and their trauma and experience and their history with slavery, their history with colonization, their history of, you know, their ancestry being wiped out here. But it was so beautiful, because I can only be a testament to the Melbourne one, that warriors of Aboriginal resistance, what they did was they invited all blackness into it. So there was a case here of David Dungy, who was saying, "I can't breathe," when he died. So they invited, you know, family members of all of a lot of the people who whose family members had died in custody, but they also invited other forms of blackness. So they invited an African-American, I think he was a scholar or a doctor or something like that, and he spoke of the African-American experience at the protests. They had invited African voices, African-Australian voices that were there. They had just done so much to be, to just talk about like the minoritized experience there. And it was really beautiful. But I think the biggest thing that I'm finding here, and even with my own page, and I've got this huge influx increase of viewers since this whole thing that's happened in Flemington, North Melbourne Flats, is the white gaze that happens and the white allyship that happens, and how, and if it wasn't for them being there, we wouldn't have gotten our numbers because we're too small of a minority group. But like, even them being there or having the gaze of people like going on Instagram and social media and sharing your stuff, how exposing that is. And it feels quite voyeuristic. I'm not sure if you guys have had similar experiences where they can like opt in and then they can opt out, whereas you've always opted in.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think there's so much similarity in terms of like what's happening here in the States. And we've talked about just, you know, that the Black Lives Matter movement has been in existence since 2013, and folks are finally, like white people in particular, are finally like taking a stance. Some of them are. And it feels very opportunistic and like centered on themselves and allowing themselves to alleviate their white guilt, as opposed to doing something meaningful that is guided towards Black liberation. But it's not to say also that they shouldn't be engaged in that work, right? Like, I think white folks need to acknowledge their power and acknowledge their privilege and give that up for the sake of their own humanity.
I think so. And also with that, I know even before we were kind of talking about how it is in your community and you're trying to serve your community, but then you keep getting asked through all these different types of checks and measures by the state, right? And I know I was doing research before, and there's a lot of South Africans that I read that are actually in Australia. And then I think of all this sanctioned violence against Black people internationally. I think of Steve Biko, who was in Soweto, South Africa, who was, you know, organizing against the Afrikaners, and the state killed him, right? They wrote a different story. And then you look into what's all been going on in America for such a long time. So you see from, you know, America to South Africa to Australia, it's fucking hard being Black, man. And, you know, I think maybe we should name this episode Melanator Melbourne.
I like that. I like that. Center me in everything you do, guys, please. You guys have absolutely been amazing. Like, yeah, I think what this does, and I think it kind of goes back into how we take care of ourselves and kind of the role of mental health workers, is I think one of the biggest things, yes, you need to isolate yourself and create boundaries and all that kind of stuff, but finding a sense of community and finding people who have shared experiences, shared values, shared belief systems with you, and are able to be like, look, this is what we've done, this is what you can do. I think that's part of the movement, and that's also part of the self-care as well, about being like, okay, this is not completely an individual experience. There's actually other people around me that are having this, and they've had strategies, and they might have it worse. And as a result, they actually have more resources than we do. And to be able to like, and that's why I found this the amazing thing. That's how I found you guys, is you go onto these platforms and, you know, you're not separated by physical boundaries. It's just online. Everything's online. And you're able to access that. And I think it really gives you a sense of community. It gives you a sense of shared experience and a sense of shared joy and shared strength that right now I might not be feeling, because after this, I'm going back to the flats to get medication for people. But I can at least be like, you know, I have brothers and sisters around the world who are doing the same fight and doing their own battles. And they're sometimes succeeding, sometimes losing. But I do feel really strengthened, and I having a feeling of like a foundation of Blackness that can't be kind of cracked.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
And I hope you're gonna be, I know you're gonna go certain people, which is cool, but I hope you fill up your cup, you know, whether you do it right before this or right after this, because we need each other in this work, you know. And a, you know, weird thing that I don't want to say weird, but something I just kind of came across, kind of unrelated or very unrelated, was like, in America, we have Psychology Today, and in Australia, y'all have Psychology Today. And then it's kind of like, looking at the way the setup of the website was, it looked mad similar. How does the Psychology Today and the whole payment system, insurance, if y'all need it, if you use insurance for health, behavioral health, how does that all look in Australia?
So I got schooled by a coworker of mine who's from New York. So she's moved here with her partner and her kids. So I just found out, and I'm so sorry for all the social workers out there in the States, I found out that in order to be a social worker in the States, you need to have a master's degree, right? And you also get like the amount of things that you can do in terms of diagnosing or that kind of stuff, and you know, the hierarchy of the work that you do is the equivalent of a psychologist here, but you guys don't get paid the same and are treated on the same level. So she was telling me that, and it blew my mind because she was saying that she had to get registered insurance and she had to get all this accreditation, and that she could provide clinical supervision, she could diagnose, she could do all this. I'm like, that is a psychologist here, and they and they're given so much respect. Social workers can't do that here, and you don't need a master's to be a social worker here. And like, just like the way we view things differently in different countries and what we attribute, like she's like, I can do so much more in the States in terms of what she, like the work that she's doing, but we'll not get paid for it. We'll not get, reimbursed appropriately, but she can come to Australia and do less and get paid way more.
Mm.
So it just like blew my mind that this existed, and that, like, what we value in different countries is completely, completely different. And we have a federal healthcare system, I think, because I think you guys have kind of like Obamacare. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, yeah.
I mean, for the time being, yes.
Trump is chipping away at that.
Yeah.
So, like, as of today, this time, we have Obamacare. Right. Might not be by the time, you post this episode.
But to call our health system, like our public health system, like comprehensive in like any capacity, would be like doing like such a disservice. To like compare it to any type of like public health system in any other country would just, it wouldn't be accurate.
So just in case any viewers, listeners or any of you want to move to Australia, just so you have an understanding. Like, if you got surgery coming up or whatever. So this is our healthcare system. Is there's a lot of politics around who is kind of can fall into it, and so a lot of the times it's residents and citizens, so we're not including people who are asylum seekers, not all that kind of stuff. But essentially, for the vast majority of people, a certain amount of money is taken out of the taxes that we pay, and it goes into the federal Medicare. That's what's called Medicare system. And as because of that, I can go to the hospital for free. I can go to my GP for free. I can essentially do any major thing for free. Yes, sometimes if I need some kind of specialist appointments, if I need a podiatrist or all that kind of stuff in the public healthcare system, there's a bit of a wait list and you have to take your time. But if an emergency was to happen today, hope not. So I had a car accident last year and I was fine, but they still, in terms of concussion and stuff, wanted to take me to the hospital. The because it was a car accident, it falls under like road rules, and my ambulance ride was free, and then me being in the hospital ED admission, all the checks and MRIs and all that kind of stuff, that didn't pay for a single one of them. And giving birth is the same thing, because I know it's a huge expense for a lot of families, especially minority families. My friend was telling me, she's like, yeah, it probably cost, upwards of $15,000 to have a child and all that kind of stuff. Absolutely free. And I'm under a certain amount until you're 30, you barely even pay the Medicare fees. Mm-hmm. And if you do, it's like $80 a year or something. Or if you want ambulance cover, which I just pay for now for non-road accidents, it's like $50 a year.
Oh my God.
It's just so accessible.
That's fast. To give you an idea, there was just to receive an ambulance in the U.S., like, there are people who will not call an ambulance because they don't have money for the bill.
Yeah.
And they're scared of going into debt and bankruptcy because they can't afford the healthcare. There was just a gentleman in Seattle who received a $1.1 million bill for being treated for COVID.
Yeah.
That's the U.S.
Yeah.
I can't, you've got a global pandemic and we're receiving free testing, free treatments, everything like that. which even then there's such significant barriers to get people to get tested. There's all these other like political issues as well to get people tested. If money was an issue as well, oh, just forget that. Like, no one's getting tested. And like, I like this idea that America's so amazing. It's not until like you really, like you get a little bit older and you go and live there. And I think a PR person is amazing, right? Because everyone thinks it's the best place to be. Like everyone thinks movie, people just like stroll. Like Grey's Anatomy makes it look like Medicare is just like,
It's because like all the television programming, all the history books were written by like white middle-aged Christian men. So like if that's you, America's fucking great. Like you're having a time. But then so like you were kind of speaking towards like accessibility of like healthcare. And so even like here in the States, like even looking at like accessibility of healthcare and then accessibility to like mental health care are like two different things. Even that, like accessing mental health is even sometimes more difficult than accessing healthcare. So like, what is it like out there? And like, are mental health services like just as easily accessible as well?
So here we have a public system and a private system. Mm-hmm. So in the public system, look, it's state by state. There's different services that are available. You know, everyone gets a government grant and, you know, all these organizations kind of do this thing. So there's specific organizations that do certain things. There's youth services or mental health care. Like I work for a sexual assault service that's like that's free. So essentially people can like refer themselves for any kind of history of sexual assault. Yeah, so that's available all around Victoria. I'm sure other places in Australia have similar things. So family violence is separate, other kind of disability separate. So all those kind of things are separate, which is good and bad. But then you go into the private sector where is a majority of people accessing mental health in the private sector. And this is kind of where it gets messy because what our government through Medicare has provided us is that individuals through their GP referral are able to get 8 to 10 heavily subsidized sessions, right? Mm-hmm. A year, right? So let's say, you know, someone is costing around $150 an hour and Medicare covers $110. You're only paying $40 out of pocket for those 8 to 10 sessions in that year. After that, you pay whatever their hourly rate is. Now that is only applicable for people who are able to register for Medicare. So that is a psychologist. And then that is a mental health social worker. So mm-hmm. a social worker who has gotten on top of that, their mental health registration, it's not counselors. And I'm a counselor. Mm. So in order for me to then go and get that done, I would have to do 2 or 3 years of further education. I'm not going to speak about our education system, but after being in North Carolina, we beat you in terms of like free education and paying for education. The government, our government pays for education and we pay it back slowly. And if there's, you know, you have to earn a certain amount. There's no one calling us trying to get money from us. There's no like interstate fee or all that kind of stuff. That, are you studying in state or out of state? Are you, you know, what's your call? There's none of that. It's just, are you international or a national student? That's it.
Again, people will declare bankruptcy here in the U.S. thinking that they'll have their student loan debt forgiven, but that's not part of having their debt wiped away. Like that student loan debt is going to stay with you forever.
Like, well, do you not want anyone to educate themselves? Like, what are you supposed to, like, sorry, this sounds so like anti-American, like tirade I'm going on here, but like, it just, like every other country is looking at you guys like, why? Why has everyone just left? Like, I get it. Like, I shouldn't be saying that, but like, it just, you know, all the international students are sitting there looking at like everyone in America, like, you guys have to pay. I paid more, like, in one semester that I did in North Carolina than I did in my like whole 3 years there. Like, if I had to do that every semester for the whole of my degree, I'd be bankrupt, like you're saying. So anyway, so all that kind of stuff are just, our barriers here are around ensuring that that people can get services, can get Medicare and all that kind of stuff. People are paying out of pocket to see me, which is a huge burden upon them, economic burden. So I try to make my fees a little bit more affordable, but also sustainable for myself. But they would rather pay more and get a decent service than not. So that's kind of the barriers. I know that you guys, each state is different. And is that right?
Yeah.
Because there's no cohesion over here.
Shit. I mean, there's this thing called, I talked about in the last episode, the National Association of Social Work. And like, there's, okay, so you don't actually technically need a master's for to be a social worker, I guess, to speak. There's BSW social workers, like an undergrad level. And then people like us who have masters, that's that. And then also with us, if you want to practice, like, in a sense, more mental health in a clinic or something, you usually get a license. So it's just written, these licenses, the way like the letters are different upon each state. Yeah. And that kind of actually eats, you said, first of all, I don't know what a JP is.
General practitioner.
Okay, general practitioner. Thank you. I didn't know, my bad. And then also, as far as like clinicians goes and everything like that, like, yeah, we may not have the doctorate in front of our names, but we at least have the license. How is the whole licensure set up if there's one in Australia? Because I know in Canada, they're called registered social workers. So how is it in Australia?
So here, there is. So I'm not from the social work background, but everyone that works around me is. And there's a huge movement now to get counsellors, because I think that's there's a slight differentiation between counselling and social work, because I think social work can encompass a lot of things, whereas counselling is one of the things that social work encompasses. Whereas a counsellor just does counselling. And I think my understandings, I hope no Australians listening, because if I make a mistake, I'm going to sound stupid, is that once you get your degree, you can apply to be registered for Australian Social Work Association. And then if you want to start doing like clinical work, and to be registered through PACFA, which is like I don't know what this stands for, but basically that's how you can get your registration to be Medicare subsidized. Mm. You'd have to do your mental health creds on top of that. So right now, so the people who work in my organization who are social workers, they don't actually need to get that mental health accreditation. Just to do social work, but if they wanted to do private practice work, or if they wanted to get paid more, that's they would get their master's or they would get their mental health accreditation. And there's also one thing that really like blew my mind. So when I received an email from was out for one of you guys, from Josh, I think, there was all these letters under his name. I was like, oh my God, what's going on? And then I noticed that everyone's Instagram had the same thing that I followed in America. So I actually had to Google what all your A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the stuff that you had under your names were. And I guess that's what you're talking about. It's like people who have master's call, is that the MSW?
Yeah.
And bachelor's, BS, oh no, BS, yeah. BS.
But our letters are even like state specific too. So like here in California, I have a LCSW, I'm a licensed clinical social worker, but like the LC in Massachusetts means something totally different. And so none of it makes sense. The acronyms, none of it makes sense.
At least you guys are all consistent. Like you're just like, nothing makes sense in our country.
Yeah.
Whether it's education, mental health, like, you know what? That's what we're consistent about that.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to confuse you.
I think a lot of people also like Australia, I'm seeing a lot of similarities. And I know when I was a social worker in Brooklyn, we did mental health first aid. I had no idea mental health first aid started off in Australia. Then it came to the States.
Neither did I. that's yeah. Yeah. The mental health first aid. Yeah. I actually did one, that was, I think it was called Aboriginal Mental Health First Aid, which was just so amazing to do, to add that cultural lens onto it and to include things. And I think there's this huge like movement towards decolonizing our practice. And I think Yeah, so when I did that, I was like, yes. Like, they included other things like things around community and things around family connection, like kind of stuff. And the overlap between the countries, I think, is quite interesting. And a lot of, so I think the benefits of being in the States compared to somewhere like Australia in terms of like education, so all the things that you're doing around like sensory experience training, dialectical behavior training, all that kind of stuff, a lot of that is more accessible in America. So with my coworker, she's like, oh yeah, we just flew down to like Boston, just flew down to Philly, went to LA to do, I'm like, oh, I took like an international plane to get down there, which I'm not going to do. So I'm doing it online or doing the equivalent of it in Australia. So I think that's like one of the benefits, is that a lot of the training that goes around the world is actually homegrown in the States, and you guys have accessibility for it. And I think your organizations pay for it if you're working in private practice. Is that right?
Depends. Yeah, if you're lucky, you get paid, but yeah.
Okay.
Meanwhile, I'm out here trying to get out to New Zealand to like study more narrative practices.
We have a narrative institute here. Like, it's really, really famous in Adelaide, which if it wasn't for Corona, in October, I wanted to kind of get down there. But yeah, yes, definitely. Because I think that's all part of kind of like the decolonial stuff, isn't it? It's like going back to our roots and using our strengths as a community.
Yeah, and I think like even in the therapeutic work out here, especially within the group context, like there's such a movement around like restorative practice and restorative justice, and like a lot of that coming from like the Aboriginal folks. Like,
yeah, definitely.
And if I'm not mistaken, Jesse, you hit all of us last episode about like the ancestral significance of like narrative therapy, you know, like the art of storytelling. Like, that's the oldest, that's the most ancient practice that there is for how we come to know who we are and where we've been.
As hip-hop, griot, they tell stories, right? I mean, we're not black people, Africans, we're not really, the white man was one who wanted us to write. We're oral, we say these things. So a lot of times with African-Americans, again, I've said it before, our history is lost because we didn't really, I mean, we had to write it because we got colonized, but those stories that come from us, like, you can even, my grandmother from South Carolina, my great-grandmother, she made quilts, but that's a way to kind of keep a story about stuff to keep white people out of it, to be like, yo, like, tonight we gonna meet up at like 11:30 around the tree, and we about to get on the Underground Railroad and leave. So it's all tied in. And it's another thing, as far as there's a certain sense of mental health that like people can say you can learn a lot from Americans, but I think there's still a lot of room to grow, because I'm hearing Aboriginal mental health in Toronto. There's a spot called the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and they have like one section of the clinic that's for Black Canadians and Afro-Canadians. There's no equivalent that I know of, I'm sorry, of Aboriginal mental health for Black people in America, for one. And two, there's no center that's just strictly for African-Americans. And Boston College, I'm going to call you out right now, there's still no institute or learning or anything for Black people, and I'm going to keep my foot on y'all necks. You dig?
We dig.
Yeah, that's all I'm going to say.
Well, you were speaking about narrative therapy. I was trying to look it up, but I couldn't find it because I'm horrible at researching. A lot of that work actually came out of Africa and their partnership with, oh, I don't want to get the wrong African country. I don't know if it was Zimbabwe or something like that. You know, I'm not even going to say it, just out of Africa. And a lot of the work came out of there and then got spread around. And a lot of First Nation communities, people of color, have connected to it, because you're absolutely right. This is tying back into our history and ancestral work that we've been doing. And some of decolonizing our practice is not pathologizing, it's not individualizing. It's going back to connecting with community, which directly opposes the individualistic, the capitalist, the white supremacist structures that we've had, where it's like, you go through your struggle alone, and you know you're facing this, or the issues that you're having is because there's something wrong inherently with you, instead of the system or the institution or any kind of history, the systemic stuff. So I think kind of going back to kind of that work and for me, narrative and body work. So some of that sensory work going back into the nervous system, I think is so important. Because if you're looking at it from like a racial view, our nervous system is constantly activated, it's constantly triggered, it's constantly on high alert. And we're working ourselves with and not resting often, that doing that work back again. And if you center trauma into it and you think of like our trauma responses, and if we're talking about racial trauma, how that's not just the individual experience, but also the collective experience. Like I can watch George Floyd and be crying in Australia and be feeling that pain in Australia and going to work upset. And collectively that's a body experience, and that's something that white supremacy is saying that, you know, actually has nothing to do with you. And that's what it says here. That's what our prime minister, so the Donald Trump of Australia, said: we're not going to bring in a movement that's like an overseas movement into this country right before we protested. So it's kind of like I love focusing on these things that we're told not to focus on, that we're told is insignificant, that we're told is not actually part of our healing, when it's part of our pain.
Absolutely. And when it's people in power telling you to silence or be quiet or move on, fuck that. We're going to amplify it.
And I mean, there's a group of all this being said as black people, people of color, marginalized groups. We're all marginalized. We're kind of outcasted. And there's one of my favorite hip hop duos is Outkast, and they have a song called The Art of Storytelling. But Outkast stands for operating under the capitalist American system for too long. And that's what we are, from Oakland to Williamstown to Philly to Atlanta, a white Atlanta to melanated Melbourne. You know, we're all operating under this thing. And it's a global struggle. And for him to even say that, that just shows he doesn't realize, like, this is like another country. No, there's black people in this country. There's black people all around. And for him to say that, that's very ignorant. And that's very just uninformed and just cold blooded.
Yeah. But one of the, I mean, power respects power, right? So, you know, I doubt he was the originator of that stance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I know we've talked a lot in depth about a lot of these very deep, hard topics in an Afrofuturistic world where there's black people at the top, because the Bible says the first shall be last, and last shall be first and the first shall be last, or whatever the case may be. So let's just say black people, brown people in an Afrofuturistic world. I'm really using some Adrienne Marie Brown because I'm in an Afrofuturistic wave. If you could show us in that ideal or more ideal world where there's no COVID around, you know, Melbourne, what are some places that you would take us to eat, some culture to take in, some history to take in, some views? Like, you know, what's the vibe? Because I know in America, I think millennials, especially black millennials, are very into brunching. It's a big scene. And when this shit's over, the turn up for the brunch is going to be real. So by that same token, what do y'all do to turn up, or what do you do to turn up in melanated Melbourne?
So first off, Melbourne is brunch central. We have the most cafes. We have we're over the top and overpriced when it comes to the food culture here. Absolutely, I would eating. So one of the best things that have happened out of all this stuff that's been happening with the flats and entertainment is that a lot of local groceries, local restaurants have been like feeding us, because they were like, the first 2 days no one ate, no one was eating food, everyone was so distressed. And I think I had water for the whole day, which obviously is not sustainable. But the food that we're getting, we got stuff from like New Somali Kitchen. So like we had like Somalian food one day, and we had Jamaican food the next day. So like it was just like there is a huge culture, and there's a huge culture of American food. that's a type of food. So I think the biggest shock that a lot of my American friends are finding is like how the food industry has kind of monopolized the awe and wonder of like hip hop, America, and food. So you're going to be places and you're hearing like Biggie Smalls and Tupac, and then they'll be serving you like fried chicken and all that kind of stuff, and like with maple syrup and waffles, like waffles and chicken and burgers, like all that kind of stuff. And people are going out of their way to eat American food, whereas Americans are like, don't eat our food. So I would be taking to you. So I'm Ethiopian. My mom had a restaurant for 10 years. I'd be taking you guys to my house so you guys can get restaurant quality food, and be eating all of our, you know, intestines and all that kind of stuff.
Black Americans call those chitlins.
Chitlins.
Like, it's called chitterlings, but we call it chitlins.
Like shit? Like S-H-I-T?
It smells like shit, but... like not shit, but chitlins.
Chitlins. Got you. So I was like, again, with PR, it cannot be called. Yo.
It'd be dope if I could set up like a chicken and waffle, shrimp and grits type spot, like soul food. I got a lot of roots from the Carolinas, so I could have a Carolina kitchen in Melbourne. Maybe, yep. You know, we should all melanate our social work. We're all together doing that. We have some type of
restaurant.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%.
Black American food, that is. So.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting seeing like Black American culture being capitalized by non-Black people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
Oh, yeah.
And even like, even within Black people, like the things that we focus on. So there's a lot of hip-hop shops. so like there's Culture Kings, which is the biggest one in here, which is just basically white people who invite artists and whatnot and kind of profit over Black culture. So whether it's the pants, whether it's the shoes, whether it's the caps, and do shit all for any Black Lives Matter movement, for any, the way they racially profile people entering the building. But you're profiting off us, like you're, and the people buying your shit are honestly, they're not Black people. There are some problematic brown people that are buying stuff from them, but largely white people who, like, you know what I mean? And it's just, that's what happens with Black culture here, and all that fetishization, all that colorism, all that kind of stuff. It's like on steroids here because we're like surrounded by whiteness.
It's on steroids here too. Like, yeah. I was just thinking about this couple that started like Thug Kitchen. Like Thug Kitchen was a white couple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same. All you have to do is go to a white suburb. It's the same vibe.
Sure. But here, every suburb is a white suburb. even the Black suburbs. But I'll also take you to what I would want to see, because I don't get to see my own city. Like, no one really tours it when you're the person living it. I'm going to see a lot more First Nation spaces, I think was really important for me. So I went to a few galleries that centered First Nation art, and there was some like community spots that had their artwork that you could buy and sell. And I think it's really, really beautiful to kind of immersing yourself in that space. Yeah, there's like an Afro hub here as well where you can go to receive some food and to listen to poetry and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, just kind of like surrounding yourself. It's really, I think it's hard if you're on the outside and really relearning how to kind of get into there is something that, have you guys heard of Sampa the Great?
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
So she's in Melbourne. Like she's a Melbourneite. Like she's from here. So she was singing during the Black Lives Matter protest as well. So like there's some really great stuff, but it's kind of really scattered because that's how we are. We're all completely scattered. We're not, and we're such a small minority. But yeah, and like another thing that I, when you said Afrofuturistic, the first thing I thought of was Wakanda and Black Panther. And it being, when I first watched it, to see my culture, because it's Wakanda supposedly in East Africa and Ethiopia is in East Africa. To see stuff like our traditional clothes on TV, and to see like our jewelry and all that kind of, like that experience was like, what is that? Is that a cross? Is that a necklace? That was so amazing. And I just want to have that experience all the time. I want to have that joy all the time. So to try and infiltrate every space and fill it with us. I think that was done on a big level with Wakanda, but I want to keep doing it here.
In America, I would say kind of what the closest you may get to Wakanda would be a historically black college university, where there's black people from all over. There's African-Americans, Afro-Latinos, black people from the Caribbean, so much blackness. But with that being said, this is kind of like my final question before I know you have some. Do you think that sometimes African-Americans have a certain amount of privilege by being noticed and talked about in their blackness in regards to or in comparison to maybe non-American blacks?
So some of the issues that happened here, and rightfully so, was the First Nation community saying, we've been saying deaths in custody is an issue. We've been protesting, but we only got all those thousands of people out is because an American man died. A black man died. We didn't get the same protest for Breonna Taylor. Right. So I do think there's certain privileges in terms of, the viewership and people following what happens in the States, which is really, really frustrating if, you know, you've been experiencing these things for a while. So I know like in England, they've been fighting for so many things for such a long time. And it's like George Floyd, Black Lives Matter. Oh yeah, let's jump on it. So like you can use that movement for your own, but it can feel really invalidating that when it's like, this is happening to us all the time, but until, because everything of ours is kind of like influenced by America, our news, like there's a whole segment of just like what's going on in the US, you know, and you guys wouldn't have a whole segment about Australia for sure. But we're not as big in terms of global influence, and, you know, our president is not so, you know, just out of this world. So I do think there is a certain level of privilege in terms of like getting your information out, but then I'm not sure if I should call it privilege, because your trauma is also just as huge. Like, I think, you know, the history of what's happened in America, the impact of it, the statistics of it that you just said, 1 in 3, like that's a lot of other countries can't have that in the same light. So I think it's not necessarily privilege, but I think it kind of comes in that kind of to and fro, where it's like, what can any other country say that they've had this same thing happen to them to this severity, to this extent? And as a result, the numbers that even as a minority that occupies in America is a lot more bigger. So it would be more impactful, and movements like that are in the millions. We're here, it's in the thousands. So yeah, I hesitate with the word privilege, because I think, well, you're also disadvantaged as well, because, you know, what's happened is a lot, I won't say worse, but just, yeah, I think I can say worse. I think I can say that if you've got a history of slavery that's gone on for as long as it has in the States, and we just keep changing the name each time. Right now it's voter suppression. You know, at a certain time it was called Jim Crow. Like the name of the oppression just keeps changing, but the way you're oppressed just gets more smarter and better. I wouldn't call it privilege. I'd say that It's part of the package deal.
Malcolm X said racism is like when you get a new car, there's always a different model each year.
Yes, exactly.
The black struggle. I mean, I've been overseas and around, and you know, I can see the black struggle from Montreal to Toronto to Paris to fucking even Johannesburg, South Africa, or even Tokyo, you know? And it just goes to show you that the struggle again that we go through, it is global, you know, and sometimes you don't even need white people to be around for there to be a white supremacist system, right? So it's inside
our bodies. It's the way we're treating each other. It's the way I view myself when I look in the mirror, and the way I speak to myself. That's the legacy of it.
Mm-hmm. You have any questions? I know you said before you asked some questions for us.
Look, you guys have been amazing. You, anyone listening, I just my American hate that just came out. I am so I have said some awful things. I might have to make a PR statement where I'm like, the views were due to stress and not sleeping. Sorry to everyone.
No, it's facts. I think it's necessary for people to have someone outside of the U.S. be critical of how we do things, particularly when, like, you've been to the U.S. and you've been educated here, and you've experienced like what it's like to be a person of color, like a black woman here. Like,
right,
it's necessary for folks to hear. Like, it ain't la-di-da.
And I think like a lot of our listeners and folks who follow us like equally have like the same critiques of the U.S. That's why a lot of us got into these fields of like trying to create change, because we saw that shit was just inherently problematic, and that it's like, you know, white supremacists, and that's the shit that we're trying to dismantle.
Yeah.
I ain't no patriot. I don't care if the Patriots got Cam Newton, but anyway.
So just don't be in my DMs. I'm gonna social work and be like, check your fans. But you know, it's been amazing, and I hope through the criticism of it's validating and affirming that people outside of the country are seeing what's happening in the country and saying that is not okay, that is not normal, even though it's your lived experience and it's been normalized. It should not be that case. And there are examples everywhere else who are doing superb, that shouldn't be happening there. And there is a bubble of an experience there. And if you think of trauma and how, like, when you're in it, it just seems so normalized and it just seems like this is the way things should be and have been all the time. When someone coming outside being like, actually, no, you actually have a right to education. You have a right to your well-being. You have a right to your agencies. And this is happening elsewhere, and it should be happening here. And it shouldn't be, the onus shouldn't be upon the people who are being marginalized and being victimized by what's happening. It should actually be the onus of the perpetrator or the systems around them to do that. It's not, but hopefully just by normalizing it and validating it and saying, we hear you, we see what's going on, we think it's not okay as well. And when we're marching, of course we're marching for ourselves, but we're also marching for what's happening there, and we're sharing what's happening there, because we know if you're over there and what's happening to you guys gets affirmed and validated, that will have a ripple effect on us as well, that will be affirmed and validated as well.
Absolutely.
For sure. Hey,
thank you for having me.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you, Tiggis, for rocking with us and answering all of our questions. It's been a great conversation. So any of the Australian social workers that are tuning in now, you know what I mean? Make sure y'all are checking out Melanated Social Work. Make sure y'all are hitting the link tree and donating to the Venmo and the Cash App, because we got this fucked up education system, y'all, and we are drowning in student debt.
I'll be broke forever.
Mindful Mondays is Tuesdays, 9 a.m. in Melbourne, Australian Eastern Standard Time.
Okay.
Just in case, guys. I know the time. Oh, I have on my way to Tuesdays to work. So it's 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. It's when Mindful Mondays occur.
That's what's up. Yo, appreciate that.
And Tiggis, like, have you thought about, because you're a black woman that's doing this work and people, they got to pay for this. Have you thought about setting up your own app, like a Cash App or a Venmo or something? Because you do good work. You do great work.
Can you guys explain to me this process of getting paid? Like, someone like a white guilt person messaged me like, you guys, it's all such great work. Can I just pay you for like all the things? And I was like,
Please trust that Tiggis is doing for real frontline on the ground work, sharing resources, putting her body on the line, like she's doing the damn thing. So, do you have a Venmo or a Cash App that we can highlight right now?
So, no, because technically there's no Cash App or Venmo in here in Australia.
Whoa.
And you guys can't transfer anything to me, which is like, who made that system, first off? Like, that is so disrespectful.
PayPal?
Yeah, so I need to get on that. So
yeah, get a PayPal there.
Make one today. Because I didn't know we could just get paid for this shit. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Hey, black women. Hey, black women. Hashtag hey, black women.
Yes, yes. I'm going to make one today.
That's it. Yep. cool. So once Tiggis gets her PayPal up and running, we'll make sure to share that out as this episode becomes live. Because definitely support the work that she's doing.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
All right, y'all. That's it.
Peace. Thank you for tuning in. Peace out.